Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Material Matters with Grant Gibson. That's me. As regular listeners will know, the idea behind the show is that I speak to a designer, maker, artist or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Restrictions are slowly closing in as the transmission of COVID increases, but at the moment we're still allowed out. And today I find myself in the Berkshire workshop of the high-end timber furniture maker Benchmark to talk to Sean Sutcliffe, albeit at an appropriate distance. After studying at Parnham College of Furniture, Sean co-founded the company with the late Sir Terence Conran. Initially, Sutcliffe produced furniture and fittings for the Conran shop, for Heels and Habitat, before helping Terence change the face of the London restaurant scene by creating pieces for Bibendum and Quaglino's. Since then, Benchmark has gone on to do commissions for the likes of the National Gallery, the Natural History Museum, the Eden Project, the Vodafone World Headquarters and the Gherkin, to name just a few. The company has also worked with designers such as Norman Foster and David Rockwell. Most recently, it made all the pieces in the Connected Project, organised by the American Hardwood Export Council, the exhibition of which is currently running at the Design Museum in London. Starting with a team of three, the firm now employs 70 people. In other words, Sean has built a hugely successful business around skill, craft, and of course, wood. Sean, thanks very much for doing this.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Was that all reasonably accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when one does a synopsis of what you've done, if I was picking out the projects that I've done over my, 37 years here, I might have chosen some different ones.
Well, all right. Which ones would you have chosen?
Well, I would always choose Bibendum because it was the first restaurant that I did with Terence. And I was deeply personally involved. I made a lot of the kind of highlight pieces in it myself with my own hands, and you know, I love it to bits. And the Gherkin was one that, just because I love the building, it's so iconic. I think that some of the other quirky ones that we've done, I think there was a particular favourite of mine was when Richard III was reinterred in Leicester Cathedral. We were commissioned to make the cathedra. A cathedra, I didn't know it at the time, but the cathedra is the bishop's seat. And as the bishop told me, that is the important bit. The cathedral is simply there to keep the rain off it. And the bishop wanted something thoroughly modern. And if anyone wants to look it up, you know, the new cathedra in Leicester Cathedral is a thoroughly modern piece. And it's kind of got this huge crucifix come angel sculpture above it.
It is huge. I mean, I have seen it. It is an enormous piece of work.
Yeah, things like that, quirky things like that are always a highlight. And I think that some of the stuff we've done recently, particularly over in the States, has been, you know, some of the work we've done with Cleveland Clinic or Comcast has been some particular favourites of mine, because there's some particular favourite bits of furniture and they were done on a large scale in beautiful buildings.
Mm. We talked about Sir Terence Conran in the intro, sadly died last month. You had this extraordinarily long working relationship, I think, since 1984 or 86. It depends on the news clippings.
Maybe from 83, I think.
83.
We met because he came down to Parnham to give a lecture. And somehow we just sat close to each other, got chatting. And he just asked me, so what are you doing when you leave? And I said, I'm going to go start a workshop somewhere. And he slipped me his card over the table and said, well, give me a call. Come and see me. And I did. He had this building that we're currently sat in now, which was the old headquarters of Habitat Design. So Habitat used to be run from this very stable block adjacent to his home. And they'd migrated to London the previous year. And it was kind of a bit like the Marie Celeste. They just got up and walked out and left everything. So the whole history of Habitat was here. You know, old prototypes, samples, catalogues, old graphic designs, everything was just left. And they'd all gone to London and set up in offices there.
Why didn't they take it with them?
I mean, I guess, you know, you're moving into a new office, you just don't take all the clutter that surrounds you. So we inherited all this. It's a pity that we probably chucked a lot of it out because it would have made a great archive now. But Terence and I, we actually became very quickly very good friends and actually started off, you know, living over in the house there because I had nowhere else to live. I'd moved to this area and, you know, became friends with his then wife, Caroline, and Terence. And I used to spend every Saturday. He was a very, very busy businessman, international businessman. So I used to spend every Saturday here with him. And I did that for close on 20 years, probably. And that was the time he devoted to Benchmark, to me. And it was a very enchanting, I mean, it was a magical time. You know, we met some makers. You can imagine his house guests at the weekends were extraordinary. There was a sort of stellar list of people that would come and stay at the weekends. And it was a very charmed time. And he also taught me a great deal. He taught me good and bad, but he taught me a great deal
That's quite interesting. So can we talk about what the good was and what the bad might have been?
I'm often asked what pearls of wisdom. He always said, keep things simple, do no more to a piece than it needs. You know, he was never one who wanted embellishment. So knowing when to stop is really important. And I think it's something that actually an awful lot of craftsmen do over-embellish. Or, you know, they don't know when to stop. And I'm not saying that I stop at the right point every time. Sometimes I probably stop too early. Sometimes I probably stop too late. But that was a particular point. And then sort of business-wise, I think the most significant thing in a way that he always said was always spend the business's money as if it was your own. If you'd spend your own money on it, spend the business's money off it. If you wouldn't spend your own money, don't spend the business's. And I've sort of lived by that, you know, for the last 37 years. And I think it's a useful thing for people to remember. He was notoriously frugal, of course. I mean, he would come into the workshop and he'd spend his time going around picking up screws off the floor of the workshop. And he'd say, in my next life, my career is going to be picking up screws in workshops. I'll make a fortune that way. And given that at the time he was kind of in the top 10 rich list or whatever of the country, I thought the idea of him making a fortune picking up screws. But he used to come into the workshop when we were busy. A lot of people forget that he was a maker in his young days. So he used to come in of a Saturday, because we often had to work Saturdays to get a job out on time. And he'd say, right, what can I do? And he'd take his jacket off, may or may not have put his cigar out. But he would help on a sander, stand on the back of the machine and take stuff out. Or he'd simply pick up a broom and say, well, I'll tidy up while you get on.
Did you ever criticize his work, Sean?
Sometimes I'd say, no, don't do it like that. Look.
And how did he take that, I wonder?
It was fine. I mean, you know, he was absolutely fine. When it comes to how you did stuff in the workshop, he deferred to my knowledge. But Terence has never been short of confidence in his own opinions. And so we all know he was not infallible, but he really had a huge amount of confidence in his own opinions on things. And actually, that's probably where a lot of his success came from. I think if people really believe they're right in everything they say and do, they can carry an awful lot of momentum with them. He was a great believer in energy. He always said, a little energy goes a long way. So when we were interviewing somebody for a job or some new staff, he loved energy, just loved energy. Now, we had some really very interesting people. I mean, Thomas Heatherwick used to use our workshop when he was a student at the RCA. He came down and made his early pieces here.
Well, he made his second ever building here.
Here, right? Which is the big gazebo in the garden. Russell Pinch started his career working here out of college. And I remember Terence saying of Russell, he said, I think he's the most impressive person we've met since we met Thomas. Which was high praise.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a long association. We fell out a few times. I think no one spends 37 years without falling out a few times. But
I was going to ask that, actually, because you're both quite big characters. I mean, Terence was a big character. You are a big character. You must have had some robust conversations, I imagine, at various points.
We did. And I wasn't always in agreement with what he thought. And I wasn't always in agreement with how he behaved. And I would call him to account on his behaviour sometimes, which he kind of accepted.
What kind of behaviour?
It might be the way he spoke to somebody. It might be the way he dealt with, you know, either in his work life. I mean, right up to, you know, the sort of, I remember when he had that, in my opinion, completely ridiculous court case with Des Gunnar-Wardner, who did the restaurant buyout. And so this is in fairly recent times. And they ended up in court fighting over the shares, the price of the shares. I never really knew what they were fighting about. But given what good friends they had been, I was sort of furious with both of them. And I said to both of them, you just come across as two spoiled rich men who are squabbling over something you should know better than to squabble over, which bridled him a bit. He kind of knew I was right. At least I think he did. But there were moments of really great joy. He, in his young years, it's well reported that he was introduced to France by a then quite aged gentleman, Michael Wickham, who was a photographer, I think a Vogue photographer, and something of a bon viveur. And I knew Michael in his old age quite well because he used to run the workshops here in the Habitat days. And he was the one who took Terence to France and introduced him to the markets and the restaurants and the French way of life that Terence attributed so much of his new possibility of a way to live and the early Habitat days. And Terence, in many ways, did exactly the same to me. He took me on several trips. My first trip to Paris was with him. And I went many, many times. We spent one glorious sort of gastronomic tour together with Simon Hopkinson just prior to the opening of Bibendum, when we took my very, very old 400-pound Citroën estate on a sort of week's tour down through France from one Michelin three-star restaurant to another. And I'd never been into a Michelin one-star restaurant, let alone this. And it is a complete delight. He used to take me around markets. I will always be eternally grateful for showing me a lot of things that I would never have, simply would never have had the opportunity to see. And we used to go to Milan. It was a kind of our point of reference often once a year or once every a couple of years would be to go to Milan Fair together. And that was always very nice. I mean, before that, you know, we'd also go to Cologne or even way back in the day to the Copenhagen Bella Center Fair. And I always really liked that. I liked going back. You know, he had a good eye.
Mm.
And actually, it's a very apt expression because he was blind in one eye. So, or nearly blind in one eye. So he had a good eye. So going around fairs, he was really keen at spotting winners. And I mean, you know, a lot of people have accused him of quite seriously of sort of plagiarism and nicking ideas. It's a difficult line, isn't it? Where, you know, when does inspiration, drawing inspiration, become straightforward copying? But he was always very keen to say to me, never copy anything. Look at it, see what's good in it, and draw on that, never copy. But there are a few things that he's done, which are the inspiration must be laughing, very, very strong.
Yeah. Yes, I think this is true. I mean, interestingly, in this podcast, we interviewed Sheridan Coakley in the last series, and he talked about how Terence spotted the Balzac before anybody else. They hadn't sold one, and he pulled it off the stand either in Milan or Cologne. He can't quite remember. And obviously that went on to be a contemporary classic.
Yeah, and that probably for 15 years, the best-selling chair in the Conrad shops worldwide. It was an absolute... He was very good at that. Sheridan, of course, was the lone wolf that was out there exhibiting at Milan, the sole UK exhibitor for so many years. Yeah. He was fantastic. I tremendously admire that. And I can go back, you know, from 30 years ago, he was out there, you know, peddling the UK flag.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things we try and do for listeners is describe, I mean, you've touched on this a bit, but to describe the workshop and the environment in which you inhabit, could you tell us kind of where we are?
Yeah, we're in the countryside in West Berkshire, so somewhere between Newbury and Hungerford. We occupy a converted farm, which when I started here was a working farm. And we occupied just, as I said, the old Habitat Design Studios, which is the converted stable block. Over the years, fairly shortly after I came here, probably in 85, the farm closed as a commercial farm. And all the buildings fell into total dereliction. Roofs fell in. And over the years, we acquired bits of it and refurbished it, repurposed the buildings, in some cases built new buildings. So it still very much has the feel of a farmyard, but we have 30,000 square feet of workshops here in across four buildings, which is picturesque, if not sometimes exactly efficient. You know, trundling stuff across farmyards can be a little annoying in the rain. But we have good equipment. You know, we've accumulated it slowly and carefully, but, you know, we have 2 5-axis CNC machines. I mean, I always maintain that our best tools are our hands, but a 5-axis CNC comes a pretty close second.
Because you're not scared of technology. I mean,
no, I absolutely love it. You know, if we go downstairs now and into the workshop and we look at, we've got a fabulous Gareth Neal piece in there at the moment, which is, you know, intensely technology-based. You know, it would be, I would say there's nothing we can't do by hand, but it would be damn difficult to do this without CNC technology. I love the possibilities that technology bring us. We don't use it instead of people. We sort of augment it. And to be honest, some jobs get really boring. I've had to stand at a workbench and drill 5,000 holes, and that's pretty boring. because I spent the first 15, maybe a little more years here, you know, at a workbench rather than not. So I'm aware of just how tedious some of the repetitive processes can be. And, you know, CNC doesn't get bored. But much more than that, the opportunities it opens up, not just for us makers, but for designers to be able to rationally design in curves. You know, the modern movement, which rationalized, you know, design to the means of production, brought us a lot of straight lines. And the next stage of that evolution, in my opinion, was the advent of CNC machinery. We didn't need straight lines anymore. You can go around a curve. And so we see designs becoming far more curvaceous. And that's true of whether it's in automotive design or product design or furniture design. You know, we were able to do curves rationally and without the huge expense of handwork that was previously required. I love the freedom that it gives us designers and makers to use form much more freely, to be much more sort of voluptuous in the work we can do.
Mm. And have you coped with the pandemic, Sean?
It's had its challenges. We never stopped working because we're a workshop-based business. You can't work from home and make things the way we do. So we never stopped working. We did cut, you know, obviously a lot of staff were furloughed for periods of time because a lot of things, just orders and jobs just evaporated. You know, jobs were either cancelled or delayed. And so we did have to furlough some staff for a period of time, but we fairly quickly were bringing people back. A lot of the work that we do is in workplace, and quite a lot of it is in sort of headquarters buildings. There's a big question mark. There was an immediate question mark over the development of headquarters buildings, and there continues to be a question mark over it. And certainly there's a kind of wholly new dialogue about what offices in the future are going to look like, you know, lower rise, smaller. But in our favor, the thing that all developers are talking about is making the offices, firstly, much more sustainable. Mm. Secondly, much more conscious of health and well-being in the workplace. Better quality. You know, if you want to get people back into the office, we're going to have to provide better offices, much better offices for them to work in. And that plays to something that we've been working on. Well, the sustainability thing we've been working on since the very beginning. I was really lucky in my youth to sort of have a secondhand encounter with Jonathan Porritt.
Oh, right.
And he's just opened my eyes to the fact that there was a sustainability issue facing the world. And so as a sort of, was I ever an angry young man? As a slightly angry young man. I was certainly a stubborn young man. I refused to use tropical timbers right from the very beginning. And people were just astounded. You know, wood just grows on trees, doesn't it? Mm. Yeah, but we're getting a bit short of trees. And we've been a sort of pioneer business in the world of sustainability always. You know, we were the first workshop to have FSC chain of custody, first workshop to adopt a sort of zero formaldehyde rule. We've got 2 Queen's Award for sustainable development. It's not something we've done recently. It's something we've done for 37 years. And that's just, you know, I'm an old hippie in my heart. And that's just a sort of firm belief that sits well within my heart. But more recently, we've also looked very much at the aspects of health and well-being of the built environment. So I love wood. I'm, you know, a through and through woody. And that plays very well to the sustainability argument, but it also plays very well to the health and well-being argument, you know, both in terms of its haptic qualities, in terms of its acoustic qualities, in terms of its hygroscopic qualities of, you know, absorbing excess moisture and releasing when it's overly dry. But most of all, of course, it's its immediate connection to nature.
Mm.
And I look to nature for most of my inspiration. If ever I'm stuck for inspiration, I look to nature to say, what would nature do about that? So I think that the whole health and well-being argument then extends into upholstery, where, you know, the world is full of really nasty plastic upholstery that's impregnated with copious quantities of very toxic materials to make it anti-flammable. And actually, you don't need to do that. We have a whole new upholstery system, which is not new. It's actually very old. Again, we looked at history, and by using coir and wool and latex rubber, natural latex rubber, you can make flame-proof or, you know, fire test compliant upholstery. And it doesn't sit quite the same as plastic. It actually sits much nicer, in my opinion. But it's all natural. It's all compostable. It's all recyclable. And it avoids the use of toxic fire retardants. So we're really pushing on that. I think that workplaces just need to start looking at the toxicity levels, the VOC levels, you know, the volatile organic compounds of the smell that people go, oh, that's a lovely smell of a new car. Yeah, well, you're just breathing a load of poison there. So I think that the future of work will, I think we're well placed to take advantage because we are kind of one of the beacon businesses in the field of health and well-being.
Can we talk about Connected, which is on at the Design Museum until the 14th of October, that you've been involved with? Because that seems to touch on quite a few of the themes we were talking about. There's elements of sustainability. There's certainly stuff about the future of the workplace.
And nature.
And nature.
A lot of nature.
Yeah. So there's 9 international designers, and they've designed a table and chairs for their home.
Yeah, the project sought to look at what a diverse group of designers would do with a single brief in the extraordinary circumstance of lockdown, because this was launched when the whole of Europe was in lockdown. I was interested in several aspects of it, but one was how would we manage the process of delivering projects without ever seeing the designer?
Because nobody was allowed to visit the workshop. That was key.
There was no physical presence throughout it. We'd done it before. We work with lots of designers internationally, and we do an awful lot of it over digital platforms. But we'd never done it before without some visits from them. They normally come to the workshop, a few times in the course of a project to feel, touch, sense the scale of something. But this time, there was none of that, which meant that there had to be a significant leap of faith on the part of the designer to give the craftsman a voice in whether something was right or not. Because whilst you can look on a screen and you can roughly see the proportion and the scale, scale's really difficult to judge on screen, really hard. You only really judge scale when it's in proximity to your body, when you feel how it relates to your body and the space around you. Touch, of course, is impossible. Temperature, the whole haptic thing is really difficult to convey in any way on digitally. Even color's really hard because, everyone's screens give different resolution. Mm. So there had to be a lot of trust put, which was absolutely enchanting for our craftsmen in the workshop because, they were having to, their opinion was being sought, where often they may have an opinion, but it wasn't sought by the designers. So it was sort of joyous for them to say, well, actually, I think the seat needs to be more upright, or the seat needs to be more reclined. And, the sort of decisions that they would normally might have an opinion on, but weren't able to express.
So it changes the relationship between the designer and the maker in that
Yes,
sense.
It did. And towards this trust in the maker's opinion. So that remote working was one thing, but also this whole thing of what's it like working at home? A lot of people just simply hadn't done it. I've never done it, still haven't. But for all the designers involved, they actually did, they were in lockdown and they were working from home. And in the case of Thomas Heatherwick, he just built his brand new home. He'd spent several years building this fabulous home in central London and then found it sorely lacking because he didn't have a study. He didn't have a space to work in it. So he was stuck for 7 weeks or something in his bedroom, on an inappropriate chair, at an inappropriate table. And this whole sort of underinvestment in our homes became very, very apparent.
Can we talk about your background, Sean? Your father was a pilot in the Air Force, I believe.
Actually, he was a military pilot. He was actually military in the Army Air Corps. But yeah, he was... I grew up with a very sort of military background, never grew up in England.
Yeah, you must have done a lot of travelling.
Yeah, I mean, I really only came to England when I was sent to boarding school here, as lots of military kids were back in those days. And I grew up with no creative element to my upbringing, other, I would say, than my grandmother. And I did spend quite a lot of time living with my grandparents. And my grandmother was a painter, an amateur painter, but I spent a lot of time up in the loft of her house, with oil paints and loved that. And I always loved woodworking. I mean, right from a very young age.
Well, I was going to ask, obviously, because
I still have the first things I ever made. The very first thing I ever made was a little kind of toolbox that I made in carpentry class at school. And I still have it. It's still one of my prized possessions. That struck a real chord. And in fact, I was, I suppose at about 9 years old, I found a pound note under a hedge in the garden. A pound note had blown under the hedge. My excitement was off the scale. I mean, I would have to find £1,000 or £10,000 now to have the same level of excitement, the same level of feeling of wealth, to have a pound. And I went and spent it on some wood to make a bird table. I was quite keen on birds.
What age were you at this?
I think I was 9.
Right.
And so, you know, my parents took me down to the woodyard and I bought what I needed and I made a bird table, which lived in the family, I think, for quite a long time, probably survived about 20 years.
Did your father have a workshop? Did he have tools?
No, absolutely not. No, I had to clear out an old coal shed and, you know, I made my first little workshop at probably aged, was I 10, 11 years old. I kind of asked my parents if I could clear out a little bit of a coal shed and make a workbench there.
Why wood in particular? What was it about wood that appealed?
I suppose at that age, it's simply a material that is workable. We didn't have any facilities for metalworking. It could have equally been clay. I mean, clay is a very workable material and very accessible. But wood, I don't know, why wood? It was the material that was available to me. And it was a material that I'm a deeply practical person. And it seemed to me to offer all the opportunities for practical solutions. You know, there's nothing you can't make in wood. In fact, there's one of my tutors at Parnham, a man called Greg Powersland. He now lives in Salcombe. In an old boathouse. Last time I went to visit him, he pushes this to an extreme. I went down, visited him, had supper, stayed the night. He eats off wood. His cutlery is made of wood. His washing up bowl's made of wood. You know, he lives in this absolute woody world. So there really is nothing you can't make of wood. And I didn't know exactly where that formed, but my decision to pursue a career in it came in a sort of epiphanal moment when I was 17 years old. And I'd spent the day out in the shed making a boot jack. I still have it. And in the evening, I sat by the fireside with my mum. And I remember saying to her, I think that's the happiest day I can remember, holding this appallingly amateurish piece of woodwork in my hand. And she said, well, darling, have you ever thought of doing that for a living? And of course I hadn't. You know, I was a privately educated kid. I'd, you know, been sort of groomed to think about professions and nobody even spoke about the possibility of the life as a maker or in industry. It just wasn't what was on offer to privately educated kids back in the 70s.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, were there facilities at school to do this kind of thing? It obviously wasn't encouraged as a potential career.
It was not encouraged as a potential career. There were facilities and I made some use of them. I mean, I wasn't very good at school. I was far too interested in doing all the things I wasn't meant to do. And I took less advantage than I could have of the facilities that were available. You know, there were facilities and I did use them and I did enjoy it. But I was definitely not one of the kind of creatives at school.
But your mother encouraged you?
Yeah, I mean, at 17, I'd left school and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I hadn't had a clue. And the moment she said that, and I can just remember it like it was yesterday. I can almost smell the moment. And I just thought, yes, I could make a living out of making things. And I had this, you know, very modest and simple ambition to simply be, actually, I wanted to be the best at something. I always remember I wanted to be the best. Whatever I made, I wanted to be the best at it. But that might have been a wheelwright or a box maker. I don't know. I had no particular vision.
So you're very competitive then?
I, of course, wouldn't say I was competitive at all. Some of my family or and certainly my wife might disagree with me. But Parnham had just started at that time. And my mum was, you know, we were Dorset-based. We were very aware of it. And in fact, a friend of mine from school had gone in the first cohort to Parnham. And so I started looking around workshops and going and visiting workshops and talking to makers. And the more I did it, the more I appealed. I applied to go to Parnham and didn't get in. And anyway, I couldn't have afforded it. My parents certainly couldn't afford to fund me through it. So I went to London, where my brother had just started as a banker, and he was able to borrow some money from his bank. And together we bought a flat, and I spent a year just doing up a flat, and I made enough money to then take myself through college.
Right.
And I reapplied to Parnham and got in, and really didn't look back from that moment. I absolutely loved you know, the education, the process. It was, Parnham was a very special place at that time.
Well, let's talk a bit about Parnham, because Parnham College of Furniture, as it's officially known, for people who don't know, was set up by the furniture designer John Makepeace and textile artist Anne Sutton in Dorset, as you say. It was like a private school, fundamentally, for furniture makers working in timber, essentially. There were small cohorts of students. I think I'm right in saying that year groups were, the whole college actually was only 22.
20, which 20 were 10, 10, 10 per year.
Yeah. David Linley went there. Constantine Grittich, quite surprisingly, I'd suggest, went there. And as you alluded to, it was perilously expensive. I mean, it's something like £3,000 a year. Eton at the time was only £2,500 a year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I actually remember it was £5,000. When I went, it was £5,000. Because I had to save myself £15,000 to get myself through the 2 years there, which I did. 2.5 years in London, I saved myself that 15 grand. And the moment I had that 15 grand, I left London and went, took myself to college.
So what was it about Parnham?
It was the sort of pure devotion to the material of wood and to the pursuit of excellence of the craft. And as I said, I'd kind of already decided I wanted to be the best at something. Whatever I made, I did want to be the best at making it. And I was, you know, I had a little woodworking business in London, but I was constantly reminded how appallingly bad I was at it.
You know,
I
mean, but you reminded yourself you were bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could see what I was doing. I mean, it was functional. It worked. I made a living, and I did some things that, you know, maybe they were fine, but I was constantly aware that they were way less good than they could be. And then when I got to Parnham, and it was a kind of strange, almost monastic-like environment with 20 people living in this big old stately home deep in the countryside. I mean, like miles from anywhere. And you spent a long working day. You know, you started in the workshop at 8 o'clock in the morning and you worked an eight-hour day in the workshop. You then had a couple of hours of lectures in the evening and then pretty much everyone piled back into the workshop and you were there until, you know, the late hours of the night, unless you skipped off to the pub for a pint. But we had the most stellar list of people. It was attracting lecturers. I mean, I'm sitting in a Fred Scott Supporto chair. Fred was one of
classic
my tutors there.
Chair, yeah.
We had an absolutely stellar list of tutors who would come and spend 2 weeks locked away in the countryside with their students and lead projects. It was an amazing opportunity. I didn't always like the work that John Makepeace was doing himself. Again, it was maybe too little too embellished for my personal taste. It wasn't, and John, if you're listening to this, in case you didn't ever realize it, of course you realized it. You know, we have a different style of design appreciation, but I never doubted his, you know, he was absolutely world-class in inspiring a generation of makers and a generation of craftsmen. And I will always be fantastically grateful for what he did. And, you know, he just brought together amazing people. And yes, there's definitely two thoughts. I mean, a lot of the work that came out of Parnham was really tortured.
There's a school of thought that says it perpetuated the kind of over-embellished arts and crafts aesthetic that held British furniture design, back.
Back, yes.
You'd agree with that?
I would absolutely agree that there was a strong element of that. But, I mean, I came out of Parnham, loaded my tools in my car and drove straight up here to join Terence. Mm. So maybe I was unusual. I was, you know, I wasn't in the classic Parnham mold in that sense. And even actually when I look back on my designs that I did there, they were all, I'm still proud of them all. There was no over-embellishment. There was no over-crafting. They were all, you know, kind of pared back pieces of work.
Mm. Which presumably John didn't mind. I mean, it's very different because, as you point out, it's very different.
Completely appreciated it. Absolutely appreciated. I mean, you know, we don't just appreciate our own style. I mean, you know, and he was very appreciative of that I was a different kind of designer, a different kind of maker. But it was a very intense 2 years. And I think in 2 years there must be equivalent to about the average of 6 years of normal student life because we just worked such long hours. Just worked, you know. Often we'd work right through the night to do a deadline. I remember working 2 nights and 3 days nonstop to finish something for the RSA annual design competition. I hadn't slept for 3 days and 2 nights and then drove my submission to make the 12 o'clock deadline at the RSA in London. There was that amount of dedication to what we were doing.
As you said, this is where you met Terence. I mean, what do you think Terence saw in you?
Oh, I have no idea. I suppose the energy, you know, he liked energy. Do you know, I never asked him that question. He could see that I wasn't, the work I was doing was not in the sort of overworked perhaps classic sort of Parnham idiom. So I think he quite liked the work that I'd done there. He, I guess, liked the energy. I think there's one thing you can be blessed with in life, it's to have a good amount of natural energy. And I've always had a good amount of natural energy, and it's not something that, you know, I mean, I was just born with it.
Mm.
I don't know. I should have asked him that somewhere in that 37 years. I should have asked him that question.
Was there a plan when he set Benchmark up? I mean, Terence, as we've discussed, is a man who knew how to turn a profit.
At the very first time meeting that I came up here and we sat in his drawing room having a cup of tea, and he said, can you ever see yourself running a factory, making stuff in volumes? And I said, yes, I can. Now, I don't consider that I do run a factory now. I run a large workshop. It doesn't work on the principles of a factory. But
what's the difference?
I think the difference is the means of production within a factory are set up solely for the batch production of a sort of narrow-ish range of items, whereas our workshop is incredibly flexible, both in terms of craftsmen and the facility within the workshop and the space. So a job like Connected that we've just done at the Design Museum, that could never be done in a factory. You know, there's 9 wholly diverse things with completely different sets of skills. I think that generally in a factory, any individual will do one part of a process, one process as part of the whole, whereas in our workshop, it's not absolutely holistic. Not everybody does their own machining, their own making, their own polishing. People have specialties, but they're all capable of doing all of those. And to a large extent, they often do. But I think Terence, he was always more interested in producing stuff at a price. He was castigated me for 37 years about, oh my God, this stuff you make is so expensive. It's all too expensive. And I said, Terence, it's beautiful though. You know, he's always wanted stuff to be more affordable.
Mm.
From an early stage, we knew this was never just going to be a little one or two or three man workshop whittling bits of wood. It was always going to get into some batch making, some volume of making. And, you know, I firmly believe that if we want to make a difference, you know, we need to make more than one of things. I fully respect those who do make one-offs, and I thoroughly enjoy making some one-offs. But I think I get my biggest buzz comes from when we load a series of containers with 500 bits of furniture and take them off to another part of the world and install them there. You know, and you just that sort of craftsmanship at scale. I love craftsmanship at scale. Yeah. I love the fact that you can still, you know, I'm a huge respecter of Victorian craftsmanship. Just the fact that their hands, their brains and their hands were so attuned to making stuff well, at volume, at scale. I really like that. I really love seeing a batch of components all made, you know, all beautifully made. I'm really big on good quality.
Well, there's this lovely quote that I found that you said, where you said, I profoundly believe that the value within a society and our economy of artisanship is a very high value and one that is undervalued considerably in this country. Do you think we have a problem with artisanship?
Yes, craft absolutely. In Britain? What I'm alluding to there is a much deeper malaise within the country, in my opinion, which is that we value the so-called professions ridiculously highly, and we undervalue artisanship. That is hugely to the detriment of industry, of society. It gives this kind of distribution of wealth. You know, ends up, all wealth ends up in the hands of the professions, pretty much.
Not journalists, just so you're aware.
Okay. I'm thinking of those sort of classic, you know,
proper
the
professions.
Proper professions. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
journalism is not.
People like lawyers and accountants and bankers and all those sort of professions. Yeah. And I live in a sort of half Danish family. My wife is Danish. And I love the fact within Danish culture, trades and artisanship are valued every bit as much as any profession. So you end up with a society where people feel equally valued, whether they're a tradesman or a lawyer or a doctor. You know, and there's not this horrible division that we have in the UK
Well, we've just had Boris Johnson come out and give another one of those speeches which successive Conservative prime ministers have given, where he talked about the pointless, nonsensical gulf that has been fixed for more than 100 years between the so-called academic and the so-called practical side of education. And he added that everything is ultimately a skill. I mean, I guess you'd agree with that, but I wonder if you think this government's going to do anything about it.
I would. And in fact, I missed the speech. I know it was made a few days ago, and I did see, caught out of the corner of my eye on a TV set, a picture of him with his tie tucked into his shirt with a plane, planing a piece of wood on a vise. And I had a mixed feeling. I mean, A, I thought, oh, for goodness sake, what are you doing, you clown? And then I thought, but actually, if we can shine the spotlight on that, I didn't realize he'd said those words, but I mean, of course, I would absolutely agree with those. I think that at a society-wide level, there is a massive underappreciation of trades, you know, whether it's stonemasonry, building work, plumbing, craftsmanship. I mean, just look at the state of our construction industry. You know, we don't have a construction industry anymore. We import all our labour. I mean, apprenticeship, I'm hugely keen on apprenticeship, and we've run an apprenticeship.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because apprenticeship has been really important to the growth of your company.
It's been vital. It's been the pillar on which the whole workshop is built. We've been running an apprenticeship scheme for 33 years. We've still got a member of staff who's been here more than 30 years. We've got lots who've been here more than 25 years and 20 years and so on, who all came through an apprenticeship scheme. And I love the transition from school leaver, sort of shy, awkward, gangly school leaver, which I recognize in myself as that age, to the sort of confident young man that emerges some, I don't know, 3 or 4 years later, who is some sort of master of their craft, but also has some diversity of experience and is able to say, I can say, Ben, can you go to Hamburg and do that job? And they go, yep, just tell me where to go. You know, I love that transition that happens somewhere between 16 and 21, 22. But you need, the employers really need to invest in it. And it's, if you're going to do it properly, it's not cheap. It's an expensive program. And we were really lucky that close by here is the BMW Mini plant up at Oxford. And they run, I believe that the Germans run the best apprenticeship schemes in the world. And they, and Mini factory runs a first-class apprenticeship scheme. And they are so generous with their knowledge sharing. So we're welcome there anytime. They've welcomed us several times. We go in, we can really look at their processes, and we've modelled a lot of what we do on what they do. And it's all about visibility for the young person coming in and being able to see their progression over the years ahead. You know, they want to see a timeline plan that shows what skills they're going to learn, when, what their stage markers are going to be, what their incremental rewards are going to be. And the typical experience of apprentices in this country is that, you know, they turn up to work really excited because they've been looking forward to their first day at work for months or years, and they knock nervously on the door and say, I'm Tom, I'm the new apprentice. And the boss has forgotten they're even starting that day. They go, oh yeah, look, go and shadow Chris for a bit, and I'll come and join you later. And suddenly, you know, the whole dream is shattered. They need to turn up and they need to have a clear plan. The business needs to have a really clear plan about what you're doing with your apprentices. And it takes time. We have an apprentice manager whose responsibility is for the apprentices. We have a mentoring system, and it costs a lot of money to do it. But we end up with a workforce that is well-skilled, well-motivated, really gets the business, and incredibly loyal. I mean, you know, we have people who've just been here all their careers.
I'm interested in what you look for. There's a nice quote that I found from you where you said, what we're looking for is not a level of skill. We're looking for the heart of a craftsman.
Yeah.
What's the heart of a craftsman?
Okay, the heart of a craftsman is just somebody who wants to do something to the best of their ability. Doesn't really matter what it is. It doesn't matter whether it's cleaning the bathroom or making a wooden box. Just doing it to the best of their ability. And for many, many, many years, sometime during a week's work experience when a potential apprentice was under review here, they would get asked very casually, they'd say, oh, okay, I've not got anything to do for you for the next hour. Look, tell you what, would you mind going out and cleaning the boss's car or go and clean the van out. It was a menial task. And all those apprentices never realized that actually they were being set up, because anyone can clean a car. And if you've got the heart of a craftsman, you will set about that menial task and you will do it to the best you possibly can.
It's like the Karate Kid, Sean.
Is that? I've not seen that film.
Wax on, wax off. Yeah.
Okay, don't know that. Yeah. But if you've got the heart of a craftsman, you will do it really well. If you haven't, you're going to do a sloppy job. I do believe that it's simply about trying to do every single thing you do the best you can do it. Yeah. Whether it's, I don't know, it's slicing an apple. You know, you just, if you take pride in trying to make all those slices, yeah, the cut's good. I don't know. I think the heart of a craftsman is really significant.
You've worked with some intriguing designers, Foster and Partners, David Rockwell. I was wandering around the London Craft Week last week and saw your new piece with Matt Collins, a young designer. How do you choose who you work with?
I absolutely actually have to give credit to my wife, Lerka, who is very good at researching and pointing out the right partnerships to pursue. My wife, Lerka, is genius at steering the business in the direction of which partnerships and which collaborations to pursue. She roots that not just in things that she likes that look good, but she seeks to find designers or design mentalities within a practice that reflect deeply the sort of values that we hold. So our collaboration with Rockwell came about because they came to us initially expressing an interest in furniture that was conformed to the WELD building standard, health and well-being. Mm. And we supplied it to them. But then she immediately went back to them and said, hey, if you're having difficulty finding it, why don't we do a range together? And it was a fantastic development over a couple of years of a fabulous range of furniture. Foster and Partners, you know, I mean, I love work. I love their rigor. I mean, actually, I was there yesterday and we were looking at, and finally signing off a new chair that we've been developing for probably 2 years now. Mm. And we had four prototypes. At 10 paces, you just think they're all the same. But only when you look at them closely, you realize that that's 1 millimeter different. That's 1 degree different. And that sort of sheer rigor with which they approach things. In the end, you get somewhere that's way better than where you started, even if it's only a millimeter different.
And what about Mac?
And Mac?
He's at a different end of his career. I mean, he's a new designer.
Absolutely. Mac, and we have worked with a lot of young designers over the years. I mean, you know, we've been working with, I love, you know, the show New Designers. I love finding new designers. I love the energy. I love the enthusiasm, the sense of possibility that exists when you're 20, that somehow life burnishes off you as you get older. But so Mac, we encountered him. I was judging an award for some magazine, I can't even remember which now. Hole and Corner, I think.
Corner,
was it Hole and Corner?
Was, yeah.
And
very fine magazine.
There was this fabulous, large, overscale blue chair.
It was like a throne, right?
Yeah, it is. Mm. It, very throne-like. And it was adequately well-made. I wasn't really looking at the craftsmanship of it, but it was actually pretty well-made for a student piece. But it just had a rightness. It had boldness. And it had humor. And so, you know, I judged it a winner, and happily so some of the other judges agreed, and it did go on to win. But, and I just said that, I said, whoever designed that chair, give him my card, I want to meet him. And so we did meet. That was a couple of years ago now. And I said, I want to develop that chair into a range of chairs or some other products. I want to see what else is in your portfolio, because I really like his the boldness of his approach. And then what really impressed me, and this is recently, we'd been through various prototypes and, you know, we'd reviewed them together. And when we made one of the final versions and he came down here for the photographic day, and I said, right, Mac, what should we change before we go into full production of these? He was razor sharp in his observation, his ability to see how very small changes made a very big difference to the overall thing. And he wanted us to change 5 things. And he was absolutely right on every single one of them. They're all tiny tweaks, But the effect of those five tiny tweaks will make for a better thing.
Mm.
So I was really impressed by the keenness of his eye and also a certain sort of confidence too. He's a very quiet, very unassuming, lovely, lovely young man. But he's got a confidence in his judgment to say, I think that needs to change. Whereas lots of young designers would say, oh, I'm not sure what you think. But he's got confidence.
So he's one to watch.
Absolutely. And what I hope doesn't happen, I mean, because he's mixed race, I hope that Mac is recognized for the designer he is rather than being a mixed race designer. Although I also, whilst I can be quite critical of the sort of tokenism that's come out of that a lot of people are trying to commercialize out of Black Lives Matter, I still think that probably that is overall a force for good. The design world is notoriously short of people of color. It's notoriously short of
women
and women. Yeah. I mean, certainly within product design. I mean, I know that interior design tends to be quite sort of gender stereotypical towards female. But just as product design is, you know, just look at the attendance on courses, university courses, and in the design studios. So I would love to see more diversity. But
do you have a diverse workforce here, Sean?
No, absolutely not. And I really wish we did. We have been incredibly unsuccessful at employing or retaining women in the workshop. I would love to see change to that. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, it's a robust workshop. It's quite high volume. We make a lot of very big things, but that does not justify the lack of diversity that we have. I'm talking about gender diversity.
Yeah.
I would really like that. I suppose that our racial diversity is probably representative of where we are in the country, which is overwhelmingly English countryside white, and our workshop reflects that, which I think is also a pity. But, you know, we employ locally, and that's one of the absolute tenets of our apprenticeship scheme is, you know, if you haven't got an RG17 postcode, you know, we don't employ you because I'm a big believer in local employment. I would love to see more diversity, both gender diversity and, of course, ethnic diversity within our workshop, within our business, and within the wider business of product design. I just think it's a very non-diverse area.
I've taken up loads of your time, so this is the final question, which is really about the future of the company. And obviously, we've very sadly lost Terence. Will that change things?
It won't change the culture of the business in any sense at all. I mean, you know, I think that the culture of the business has been formed by a sort of symbiosis of what's in my heart. And a lot of what's in my heart has been guided by Terence in those early years, especially. And Terence hasn't played an active role in the business for many, many, many years. He's always maintained his interest. You know, I'd always go over on a Friday night, sit and have a drink. And you know, he's always interested in what we were doing. But the culture of the business is coming from my heart now and the heart of the craftsman that is so widely spread amongst the workshop.
Oh, well, that's a lovely, lovely sentiment, I think, in which to leave this. Sean, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
To discover more about Sean and Benchmark, go to benchmarkfurniture.com. There are images from the interviews as well as little films and other things on my Instagram page, Grant on Design. And guess what? I have a new website. You can find all the podcasts that I've done, sign up to my newsletter and lots of other stuff at grantondesign.com. If you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this from. And if you feel so inclined, you can go to my Patreon page and make a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. You'll be helping to take the message of the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. Thanks so much for listening, and please stay safe and well.